Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. Great to have you company for another episode of our show. Now my guest today is Graham Winter, and Graham is a psychologist who has an incredible pedigree. Graham has worked as the chief psychologist for the Australian Olympic team 3 times. And on top of that, in his work in the corporate world, he's worked with large organizations, including defense organizations, multiple universities, lots of medium and smaller size organizations as well. And his focus has always been around helping people perform, whether that's in an individualistic capacity or as a team. So today we talk about building psychological resilience, being psychologically strong. In Graham's work with the sporting world, he noticed that people might be physically strong or physically fit or really capable in their discipline, but perhaps not psychologically fit. And part of building a great business and having a great life is being psychologically fit. How do we cope with change? How do we build great teams? How do we become our best version of ourselves? How do we know what's limiting us and what are the blind spots that we don't see? These are all questions that as business leaders we need to address. And what Graham talks about in this episode are the tools that are going to be really helpful for your toolkit to be able to do just that. So this is an important conversation. If you want to grow a team, if you want to be your best, if you want to do great work, then there's going to be plenty of gold in this conversation for you. So as always, do have a pen and paper handy because there's going to be some notes that you're going to want to take. Now, as a side note, I really want to encourage you to come across to SavvyDentist.com/magazine and grab a copy of the Savvy Dentist magazine. It's a magazine that we've put together, which is all about the business of dentistry. It's for practice owners, by practice owners, and we talk about all the things that are relevant to day-to-day dental practice from a business perspective. It's a free magazine. You can get it in print format or digital format. And as I said, all you need to do is go to SavvyDentist.com/magazine and it's yours free. So go ahead and grab that. And I hope that's a really useful resource. But for now, let's get on to our conversation with Graham Winter. Here he is right now. Graham Winter, thank you so much for taking the time to come and hang out with us on the Savvy Dentist podcast all the way from Adelaide. How's things with you today?
Jesse, really good and absolutely delighted to spend the time with you.
Well, mate, I'm really excited to talk to you because you've got a pedigree and a background that is actually really striking and really remarkable. You're really well known for the work you do with Think One Team and Toolkit for Turbulence, but you're also just as well known as being the chief psychologist for 3 Olympic teams, including the Sydney 2000 Games. Yeah, the theme of your work seems to be about helping people perform really well in their role. How do they get the best out of themselves? How do they do really well? I'm curious to just start the conversation by saying, like, how did you find your way into those roles? Has it always been a curiosity or a fascination for you about what separates performers from non-performers? What got you into that?
Oh, I'll try not to make it a long story, but if I put it in about 5 short sentences, had no idea when I was at school what I wanted to do. My parents sent me to get vocational guidance with a psychologist. The psychologist said you should do law. I walked out going, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a psychologist. Went to university. I played first class cricket. Through those sort of early years, and the coach of the South Australian cricket team, we won a Sheffield Shield and a One Day Cup competition back in those days. He happened to be on the board of the Institute of Sport. I was working for Coopers and Lybrand, just started off in consulting, and I got an offer to say, would you be interested in setting up a sports psychology unit? I read a sports psychology book the day before the interview and went in and got the job, and have kind of had that thread of performance psychology and sport and business running right throughout my career.
With sports psychology, obviously you're working with a group of people that are obviously really talented. They don't get into those elite programs unless they have talent. They've obviously worked hard as well. Why is it, do you think, that some people hit those really high levels and why others who have similar amounts of talent do the work seem to not quite make it? What is it that separates the real champions from the rest? The Novak Djokovic is from, you know, the rest, right? What makes them so good?
I mean, you've got a few like Djokovic that are the absolute stratosphere. So I think like any sort of field, you'll get the occasional genius. You know, Shane Warne would be an example in cricket. But I think ultimately the ones that succeed and do it over time, they learn to become what I would call a complete package. That often they will present with a lot of technical capability, and you see the same in people in business. You see the same in your clients. They'll be really good at their discipline, at their craft. The question is, can then you replicate that craft in different conditions, in challenging conditions? So it's that classic, yes, I can perform, but can I perform in an Olympic final, or can I perform at an Australian Open? And I think it's the ones that develop not just to be elite physically, but they also develop to be elite psychologically, so they can bring out the best in themselves, not just, in a sense, almost be relying on whether they turn up feeling good on a particular day. So I think it's that combination. And then we can unpack a whole lot of things underneath that. Maybe one I would add is discipline. You know, I've seen very few people succeed at that level who aren't incredibly disciplined for all sorts of reasons, but we could explore that a bit more, I'm sure.
Yeah, let's unpack a bit of that, because I think the lessons between sport and business are uncanny, and I think that there's lots of crossover and lots of parallels. And I'm curious to start with discipline just as a starting point. Discipline is one of those things that there's a great Jim Rohn quote, and I'm probably going to butcher, but he had this quote that says you can either suffer the discipline or suffer regret, or words to that effect. I can't remember exactly. The pain of discipline versus the pain of regret. Yep. And I wanted to ask you about discipline. Is it factory installed, or do people kind of learn to develop discipline over time?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I mean, I guess what you see with athletes is you're often working with people who are quite young. Mm. So you've got the natural psychological maturation process as well. But even some of the early psychological literature suggests that, yeah, kids who've got levels of ability to withhold gratification, for example, early on in life, so in other words, to put in the work now to get the reward later, become more successful. The longitudinal studies tell us that. So there's a level of, I think, nature and early nurture, if you like. But then for other athletes, there's nothing like, as we would say, if I could be so slightly crude, getting their butts kicked a few times in public in big competitions. There's nothing quite like that to get a few to really flip. And I think Federer was probably one example of that, who was, you know, quite erratic early in his career. But as a consequence of a couple of life experiences, he recognized that need to then double down. But it's also not a rigid, and I'm sure we'll talk about this here, it's not a rigidity of discipline, but it's the ability to be able to put your focus where you need to put your focus. And when it all boils down, I mean, if somebody says to me, what's the single most important thing in high performance? It's focus. Mm. You know, your ability to focus your attention, your energy on what it is that you're doing at the moment. And the question is, am I doing the right thing? Mm. Or am I in habits or patterns that are not, no longer helpful? And I'm sure, again, we'll talk about that in the context of professionals, yeah, working on their craft versus working on their business and working on their relationships and working on their team and a variety of other things. The question is, how do I provide that focus? And that's where often perspective comes in. So you'll often find good athletes have good coaches or good mentors, people that can provide them with some of that perspective, because it's damn hard to get that perspective when you're in the maelstrom, when you're in the kind of the storm.
Yeah, I really like the idea of the ability to focus on the right things at the right time to get the right results.
Yeah.
And as you say, sometimes getting that external perspective is going to be key to give you the indicator of what to focus on. Mm. In terms of discipline, you said it was not a rigidity. We're not talking about rigid discipline. We're not thinking like we've got to sleep in a wooden timber bed with no mattress and, you know, be out pack marching in the morning. So if it's not a rigid discipline, can you just help me understand and help the audience understand, what do you mean by perhaps a more flexible kind of discipline? What do you mean by that? Is it about being able to focus on and turn it off? Is it about, what does it mean?
There's a few elements to it. I mean, one's the ability to handle discomfort. Mm. So in other words, not to switch off. It's not to switch off motivation, perseverance, etc., because it's hard and because it feels uncomfortable. Mm. I mean, particularly for young athletes, they will find that their friends are out partying, their friends are out doing things, but they're not. Mm. So there's that level of discipline. There's then the ability to make the right choices. So, you know, if you look at the data on top tennis players, for example, the difference between the number of points won by, say, the top 10 and the next 30 or so is not very much at all. It's extremely small. But when you then get down to who wins the big points, that's when the top 10 come in.
Yeah.
Again, I know I'm coming back to the same thing, but there's a discipline to be able to apply your focus in that moment.
Mm.
I mean, you talk to some of the best sort of psychologists doing research work around the world, and a lot of that work is around mindfulness. And while that can have a, you know, whole lot of other connotations to it, the essence of mindfulness is the ability to be able to be in that present moment, focus on what you're doing. And in many ways, training your focus is like doing kind of push-ups for your mind. It's that same, it's the ability to do that. But then, of course, what's going on for all of us, we've all got this natural threat response. Yeah, we're all wired to, when we're put into difficult, challenging situations, yeah, whether that's a professional looking at their day going, I've got really complex challenges, I've got so many of these, and oh God, now I've got an interpersonal issue to deal with a staff member, or equally an athlete dealing with, you know, a heckler in the crowd. That ability to be able to contain your own attention onto what you need to focus on, but it can't be too tunnel visioned either. Because if you're in a football field, for example, tunnel vision will get you concussion pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So it is quite situational specific. But a lot of it is that ability to focus, and then the ability to be emotionally intelligent, or strategically or conceptually intelligent. And I would say the same with the executives I work with. It's their, you know, if you're a senior, you know, but a couple of clients who are very senior in defense, they make life or death decisions for people. You know, and the conversations we have a lot is around making sure that they are in the right frame of mind to be able to make those decisions. Or if they're not in the right frame of mind, how do they then, you know, where do they get perspective from? How do they make sure that they are aware of that? Because they will also have learned if they're in the military, for example, that if you're in an urban warfare situation, for example, you know, that ability to make a quick right decision or a quick wrong decision is a life or death decision for you and for somebody else.
Yeah.
So while that's a lot more graphic, of course, than you see in day-to-day activities, the basic principle, if I'm looking at how do I train and help an Olympic athlete to be at their best, how do I train a professional to be at their best? How do I train an executive leader or politician or whoever? It comes down to helping them to understand their own psychology, to understand what it is that takes their focus away, what habits are helpful and what not. Because what you're trying to do is help them to be their best. You're not trying to get them to be, you know, the best Jesse or the best Graham. You're getting them to be the best them.
Yeah.
So there is a level of self-awareness, vulnerability, and openness that sort of almost lays a foundation to be tough. And it's not that I'm tough, I can put up with anything. No, you can't. We all have limits. We all have vulnerabilities.
Mm.
How do we work with those is one of the keys, I think, to operating at that sort of level where you're right out there. I mean, Olympic athletes put themselves out there, professionals put their families, their clients, their community. They're responsible. You know, pilots, same thing.
One of the things about focus, you've spoken about being able to put your focus on the right thing.
Hmm.
My experience with focus is it's a bit like a muscle, is that it fatigues after a while.
Yeah.
How do you maintain focus for extended periods of time? And how do you know when it's time to give it a rest and to either take a mental break or when it's, you know, when you're trying to shift focus? Because I'm thinking about focus fatigue, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
How do people do that? How do they manage that? And then the other thing you spoke about, and this might all intertwine, so I'll ask you this question at the same time, is you spoke about being in the right frame of mind to make decisions. And part of that comes back to probably emotional regulation.
Yeah.
Again, decision-making, emotional regulation, you're under pressure. How do you maintain the ability to make those good decisions? How do you get yourself, like, if you know you're not in a good space, how do you kind of get yourself back in? And going back to the athletes, I was watching Novak Djokovic the other night. We were recording this as the Australian Open's on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there was a period of time, he was playing Taylor Fritz last night.
Mm.
And he was rattled and he was joking around and doing that sort of stuff. But then you could see just this mental switch flick.
Yep.
As like a new man. So I know that's probably about 10 questions all in one. But I know. Sorry. Can I just throw that spaghetti mess to you and see how you unjumble it?
Look, I might go completely opposite from tennis and sport and go to business.
Yeah, go for it. That's our audience, so that's great.
If I'm working with a team, one of the first things that I will be talking to them about or getting them to reflect on is their, what I call, their operating rhythm.
Yeah.
And their operating rhythm, you know, is in a team, for example, it's our alignment, it's our collaboration, it's our learning. If you think about that as a kind of loop, but you can also think about your operating rhythm as being your energy sort of flow, etc. So what I would always be doing with any sort of senior person or person in a high demand sort of business environment is getting to step back and look at 90, 180, 360 days out. And so tell me, if we look forward and we look back, what do your days look like? What do your weeks look like? Because they've only got energy to give. And as you say, it's easy to degrade performance.
Yes.
You look at high performers, for example, and they will almost always, if you go look at musicians, you look at pilots, you look at surgeons, they will pause. They'll have processes to go through before they perform a particular sort of activity, because they know that there's a period where they can really focus, and that period of time is not very long, and then they will drift away again. But their ability to do that will also be traceable back. So you then look back and say, have they been working on their physical energy? Are they physically fit? Yeah. Have they had sleep? Because if you want to upset an athlete's performance, interrupt their sleep. I mean, get them to fall in love. That would be, that'll definitely do it. But seriously, it's sleep. It's that basic energy stuff. Because it's one thing to say, I've got, a business leader who's incredibly good at making decisions. Yeah, but not if they're exhausted, not if they're fatigued, not if they're burned out. So to me, it's a discipline of the operating rhythm. I work with most of the senior executives I work with, we work on 90-day cycles or the equivalent. We look at what that 90 days is. We break it up into a four-piece framework, which the acronym is ADEP. So achieve, develop, enjoy, and partner. So let me sort of walk through those briefly. If you unpack the research around burnout, people don't burn out if those four things are in place. If they're achieving meaningful outcomes, if they're developing and growing, if they're enjoying what they're doing and feeling that there's energy coming into their system, and if they have partnering or collegiate relationships. So think about those four. So what I tend to do with anyone, and I use this with athletes as well, is one of the first things we'll do will be to look back 30, 60, 90, 180 days. Look at your ADEP going backwards. What have you achieved? What have you learned and how have you developed? What about the energy? And particularly with senior leaders, I'll often flip the enjoy to energy and say, let's just call it energy. Energy in, energy out. What's going on for you? And partner relationships. Yeah, how strong are those really important relationships within your work and in your general life? And then we work our way forward and we start to get in the next 90 days. What's important to you to do in each of these? On any given day and in any given week, you will not have a perfect balance of achieve, develop, enjoy, partner. You know, I've run my own business for 30 years. I know that I have plenty of weeks where I'm full on achieve, but also know that I know what my cycle times are. I have a coach that I have used 25 years or something, and we catch up and the first thing we do is we go through this achieve, develop, enjoy, partner. And then it's the, what rhythm do I need? What daily rhythm do I need in order to have the right energy level to be able to succeed, et cetera? Because if you keep bleeding down the energy area, for example, so where does energy come from? It might come from meditation. It might come from exercise. It might come from socializing. You know, it can come from all sorts of areas. It'll generally come from some sort of brainwave activity that's different to the stuff you're doing at work, which most business people and professionals is problem solving. Mm-hmm. So you're doing your clinical work. Question is, well, where does that other stuff come from? And if you don't get that sort of altered state of consciousness, if you like, the danger is that you'll get it from alcohol, you'll get it from drugs, you'll get it from things that will actually diminish your performance over time. Yeah. I put a lot of emphasis on that framework of ADEP. I would encourage your listeners to sort of just sit down, grab a sheet of paper, look back 90 days, what have I achieved? Developed, what have I got better at? Enjoy and energy, what's that look like? Partnering relationships, what do they look like? Okay, now let's go forward. And what a good coach is, in a sense, saying is, I know in any given week you're not going to be doing that, but I reckon every 90 days we should be able to step back and go, what's the balance look like in those areas? What's the ledger look like? And, you know, last year I wrote a book. My first part of the year was hugely up in the achieve area, a lot of develop, very little partner relationship, very little enjoy and energy. You know, I got some satisfaction out of the early part of the book, but then it becomes a massive exercise to get 65,000 words done. But I then took a solid break after that before getting back and being really clear and then having again You know, I break my year, so I have clear sort of breaks around what those are and do the gym and things like that. So I think those things are important. Think about ADEP and then think about what is your operating rhythm, what works for you. And then what I'm trying to do if I'm working with a professional is, whether an athlete or a business person, is to try to understand what works for you. And then when do you sabotage yourself? When do you get in your own way and degrade your own performance and start going, well, I'm really annoyed that I'm not being creative and innovative and taking my partnership forward or whatever it might be. Okay, well, let's have a look at each of these areas. Where can we start to move forward? Because you're going to need innovation in that area. You're going to need to make some change.
There's a whole bunch of stuff in ADEP, Graham. I imagine it's one of those frameworks that's very simple to kind of say out loud, but there's probably layers and distinctions as you go through. Yeah. So if someone was beginning this process of understanding ADEP, mm-hmm. really, I guess the first part, as you said, is to get out a piece of paper, look back, look forward, think about those four categories and go, okay, where have I been? Where do I want to go? What changes do I need to make?
Yeah.
I guess then it's about examining the habits, behaviors, belief systems that you need to adopt that are going to allow you to make those changes. What are the things that typically sabotage progress? What are the things that get in the way?
Perfectionism.
Dentists raise your hands right there.
Yeah, and I'm a recovering perfectionist. Only partially recovering.
Yeah, I'm partially recovering.
Perfectionism, definitely.
Yeah,
trying to do too much. Which, I mean, some of this is obviously perfectionism, but having too many priorities. I think not being kind and compassionate enough to yourself. So, in other words, not, you know, a good athlete knows that they need to recover, that they need to. Yeah, they're going to be best in bursts, not in just it's a marathon, but it's a series of
sprints.
For example, I think this, if I could relate to that, it's inability to build teams. You know, that sort of I need to run faster. Well, if it's a relay, it's not a question of how fast you run; it's how fast the baton goes. So how do you get the baton going faster? So it's building a team. I find that with I guess younger leaders who have moved quickly through the ranks are often very quick at solving problems. And I think professionals, dentists and so on, are very similar. Yeah, good at solving problems, good at doing the clinical work or good at doing the technical, practical work. But the more complex issues are adaptive. They're non-linear. They require usually working with others, working with conflict. They're uncomfortable. So I think it's sometimes people then get stuck in the change process and they get frustrated and they feel they're not getting anywhere, which is where the mentor, perspective, coach, colleague, friend, mate. And I was a good colleague in Melbourne. I'd rang him this morning. So you got 20 minutes. It's his wedding anniversary. So he had about 15 and then said, I need to go. But it was me saying, I'm stuck on this thing. I just need to. And it's around all of our PR and LinkedIn stuff. I've got two books that have just come out in the last 3 months. I could spend my entire week doing this stuff. I need to get some boundaries around it, but it needs to be effective. I was struggling myself, so I ring a mate because I know that's got to be a key priority, but it's got to have a boundary around it. It's got to be 80-20, not the other way around.
Not the other way. Yeah. Can we just talk a little bit about perfectionism for a second? Because I think dentists by nature are really detail-oriented people. And if you're not detail-oriented, generally you won't go into the profession or you won't last. And I think staying in the profession tends to hone that sense of perfectionism. And perfectionism for me is a bit of a double-edged sword because on one level it allows you to achieve to a high standard, but on the other level, as you say, it leads to perhaps self-criticism when things aren't right. It probably leads to setting unrealistic standards. It perhaps leads to setting standards for others that they don't even know that they've been set for them.
Yes.
You said that one of the things that prevents progress is the inability to build teams. Now, the whole premise of the work that I do with dentists in their business is to be able to work with and through other people to create, you know, leverage in their business so that they have to build a team to create leverage. And it is the simplest and the hardest thing to do all at the same time. So I wanted to ask about the relationship between someone who has a perfectionistic tendency and the challenges that they typically encounter building a team and what some of those remedies might be in terms of building effective, high-functioning, not just high-functioning, but well-functioning teams.
Yeah, well-functioning teams.
Yeah.
Look, if anyone that's listening has got a piece of paper and a pen, just draw a straight line, a vertical line, and on the left-hand side, put the word task, and on the right-hand side, put the word people.
Mm.
Perfectionism is driven from the task side. So let's just start from that. So if you are perfectionistic, you are being driven by task. Now, it's not achievement. So there's a brilliant framework that many psychs, myself included, are trained in called human synergistics. So human synergistics framework will tell you that achievement and perfectionism are right next door to each other on a framework, mm-hmm. but they're fundamentally different. Achievement, to some extent, doesn't necessarily have a level to it because you can keep going. Because achievement is about achieving a level of excellence. It's setting high standards. Perfectionism is almost the opposite of that. It's perfectionists is trying to avoid the absence of failure, the absence of a mistake. Now, the problem when you look, and I'm probably getting, but your audience is nice and technical. To the 50th percentile on that psychological instrument, perfectionism is a significant strength.
Yes.
Because it causes you to pay attention to detail. It means that, I turned up yesterday way over prepared for a client. And that meant that when we moved and we adjusted, I was able to then meet those needs and so on. But that over preparation had a cost.
Mm.
And the cost starts to come in between the 50th and the 100th percentile. And a lot of the costs are either to the person, because of levels of stress, levels of isolation, burnout and a whole variety of other things, but also in their relationships to other people. Because what you'll then start to see is they're likely to be critical.
Mm.
So there's a critic. Why? Because they've got a critic of themselves, because I'm trying to avoid making mistakes. If I make a mistake, I'm an idiot, I'm useless or whatever. So you can never achieve if you're a perfectionist, because no matter what you do, tomorrow needs to be better. So as a psych, what you're endeavouring to do is to get people to shift towards a more constructive sense of what is achievement versus what don't I want almost. But the lady who I did a bit of work with on perfectionism, I mean, the best line she said to me was, Graham, think about the cost.
Mm.
And particularly look at when you're trying to control things. That may be logical and rational because there's a level of risk, there's a level of concern. But what most leaders who manage to move their way through this is they become coaches. They recognize that I can't just hand over, but what I can do is I can coach. The cost of that, it'll take a little bit of time, but the benefit is that you are going to build capability in others. You're going to build trust in others. You're going to build teams in others. So I think it's firstly that recognition that mostly, I'm generalizing, but most dentists, and you probably want them to do this, will be task first, people second.
Mm-hmm.
When they're dealing with their teams, I'd ask them to think, what if I was people first and task really close behind? What would that mean? That means you might ask somebody how they're feeling. It might mean you might think a little bit about how best to send a message to somebody rather than just deliver the... Now, if you're in a crisis situation, sure, but most times they're not going to be.
Mm.
So I think I would... Jesse, I think I'll go back to that word cost. If your listeners are thinking about this, what is the cost for me of being continually on... trying to hit an ever increasingly high standard? What's the cost to me? What are the cost to others? And can I still achieve excellence without putting so much pressure on myself for when I do make an error or do make a mistake? But of course, there's ingrained habits, and that takes time to work through.
Yeah, and you're right. The ingrained habits, I think, is the challenging part. Is it's years and years, decades. Often patterns of behavior, habits, and so on that you need to kind of be unscrambling. One of the things that I've observed, and as I'm like you, I'm a recovering perfectionist, and I'm using the word recovering very generously. But one of the things I think that a lot of dentists struggle with when it comes to their interpersonal relations is trying really hard not to have expectation. Yeah, I'm fond of saying to people, 80% done by someone else is 100% terrific, right?
Mm.
And I really believe that to be true. But when I come to try and exhibit that in my own world, I struggle with it because I'm thinking, 100% is better than 80%, and let's still aim for that. How do you, as a leader, communicate your expectations in such a way, but make them reasonable, make them reasonable rather than kind of being this taskmaster and forever pushing, forever demanding more, and so on? How do you create a sense that the expectations are reasonable, and how do you How do you know within yourself whether it's a reasonable expectation? Because for a perfectionist, the reasonable expectation is perfection. Mm. How do you temper that and create reasonable expectations in others?
Oh, that's a big question. I think part of it is, this is getting a bit technical, but part of it's separating your intent from how you get to your intent.
Okay.
And this takes a fair level of emotional intelligence. And you're telling your team, I want zero errors here. I want this done there. I want this done there and so on. Mm. Jump up a level to why. Why do you want that? So I want to provide a completely safe environment for my clients. I want to produce excellent outcomes for my clients. And then the next level down, this becomes, can you share that next level conversation? So you can say, yeah, essentially, I own the business and these are the standards I want to see. How do we now bring that to life? How do we make that happen? Because for me, the natural way of doing it is this. How do we get this outcome? Are there other ways? And that's the conversation you were hearing in a lot of executive teams in businesses these days, because they're trying to adapt, putting in new technologies. They're all trying to operate in different ways to the ways they have previously. Their workforces are different, different values, different expectations around, you know, psychosocial risks and things like that. A CEO said to me in the last 48 hours, psychosocial risks, what the hell is that? And one of his teams said, something that you could end up in jail for. Now, that's probably not very helpful, but I think it highlights that what we're endeavouring to do and what I'm endeavouring to do with an athlete and a business person and a professional is developing their ability to learn. And in order to learn, you need to be obviously try to be adaptable, but the critical capability in a changeable environment is the ability to learn. Mm. I would encourage people to say, be clear about where you want to go, what your outcomes are. But don't, as much as you can, be prescriptive about how you want to get there. Have that conversation. As long as, I mean, obviously, if you've got new people, basic situational leadership, you know, if you've got people who are, you know, haven't got a lot of capability and not a lot of motivation, you're not asking them. But people who've been working with you for a little while, how can I do this differently or better to make it easier for you? How can we still achieve this standard? That's achievement. I mean, in my business, like, we give our clients an outstanding experience and we make sure that we do that. We tell them the truth. We deliver what we say we're going to deliver. That's the standard. Now, how do we go about doing that? That's a conversation we have with the team. And yeah, for me, sometimes that's a bit uncomfortable, but it's opening me up to learn and adapt. And of course, I can become a better coach, but it's a pretty challenging topic, that one.
Yeah, it's a big one. And I appreciate you unpicking it. But there's a couple of key takeaways I gleaned from that. So just so for clarity in my own mind and perhaps just to summarize for the audience as well, is it's about the outcome without being prescriptive of the how. But again, using that with the trusted team members who have been with you for a little while, perhaps not the first new person on their first day kind of routine. And, you know, on that, for that particular person, they might need that little bit of prescriptive way of how we do things, that, you know, in this particular practice and so on. Then over time, as trust develops, the relationships deepen, then I guess you're looking at, you know, okay, here's the outcome. Now tell me other ways that we can get there. So,
I was listening to a really good podcast from Bob Johansson. Bob was the past president of the, what's it called, Institute for the Future at Stanford. Yep. So one of the best sort of thinkers and probably the best organization in the world in terms of trying to look at the future. And his basic line is, it's get clarity, but you'll be punished by certainty. What he means, and when it was sort of unpacked, what he's saying is, what an individual or an organization that succeeds in a changeable environment will be good at is, if you think of the McKinsey three horizons, horizon one, two, three. Horizon one is they're good at knowing where they're at the moment. They know what the risk is, what the challenge is, et cetera. His point is then that your high performer goes to horizon three and then says, this is what I want. So he would say in a business, that might be a 10-year view. So in other words, it's jumping your way out. And he says the challenge is then you've got to work your way through horizon two, which is, of course, you know, maybe the next 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, or whatever. But his point is certainty will be punished. And what he means by that is no matter what you try and do, given the nature of the world that we're working in, if you're trying to run a business, your plans will get upended. But that doesn't mean that you can't be clear about where you're going, what your intent is, and what your standards are, and be clear about where we are now. But you need a team to take you between those two.
Yeah.
And that team has to learn together. And that's where we talk about align, collaborate, learn. So the whole sort of Think One Team book
yes.
is around that. Yeah, how do we align values, standards, practices? How do we collaborate? What does that mean in this context? What does collaborate mean in an airline cockpit? What does it mean in a government leadership team? What does it mean in a dental practice? And then how do we learn so that we then realign again? And it's not just learning about the technical, it's also learning about how we work together. Mm. So the characteristic of every high-performing team I've ever seen is they will demonstrate that loop, that align, collaborate, learn. You watch a special military team in operation, just a constant stream of alignment, collaboration, learning. I'm sure some of your listeners will enjoy sailing. It's exactly what a skipper of a yacht's doing. You know where you are. You've got your rigged, ready to go. You've got an intent as to where you want to get to. You do not know exactly what path you're going to take. You will adapt as you go by aligning, by collaborating, by learning. And what we do know is over time that the organizations that operate better in those environments are ones where the leadership is more inclusive of people's views and opinions and so on, rather than just being commanded and controlled.
I want to talk a little bit about changing times because, you know, if the times are changing, obviously we've got to, you know, learn as we go, things are happening. Yeah. And you talk about having a toolkit for turbulence, and it's apparent to probably all of us that we are living through a moment of great change in the world society.
Yeah.
Things are changing, everything's changing technologically, socially. One of the things that I feel, and I don't think I'm alone in feeling this, but the pace of change seems to be accelerating. Yeah. And maybe that's partly due to technology. Maybe it's the 24-hour news cycle and we feel that sense of constant bombardment. Or maybe we just feel it's changing faster than this. I'm not sure. But change can be exciting, but it can also be fatiguing.
Mm.
Mm. I wanted to ask about how to cope with change in a workplace, in a business sense. What sort of tools do we need to be able to weather that storm? And understanding that, you know, that great expression, the only constant is change, how do we set ourselves up for being able to continuously adapt to new and changing environments?
Well, there's another, there's a little 24-hour conversation.
Yeah, sorry, mate.
That's a big one. I mean, that's what we tried to address with the book, Toolkit for Turbulence, was this recognition, almost that we, I should say Martin Bean, Professor Martin Bean. So Martin was the Vice Chancellor of RMIT University for about 5 years. And I had the pleasure, privilege of working with his team and his leaders for those 5 years, of which COVID was a significant piece of it.
Speaking of change.
Yeah. So what we thought we would do, because we used a lot of Think One Team sort of framework to sort of build fast teams, and, you know, the university had an enormous financial hit, you know, $300 million off the budget, alongside obviously massive disruption of students, national students, and, you know, workforce disruption and so on. We then set about to write this book, and we felt that what we wanted to do is to share some of the things that we had used with the team and teams. There are a variety of teams there. To do that, we then went out and interviewed a number of our clients and colleagues, and they were like 15, mostly chief executives or equivalent from across sort of, you know, all sorts of different sectors, from like chief defence scientists to head of the Australian Grand Prix Corporation and so on. All of those conversations were about how the leaders have adapted to change, with COVID being almost the first wave, but it became the accelerator. And when you talk to, you know, people in tech, they'd say, well, the big turbulence for us has been capital and finance and pressure to be profitable rather than maybe to grow fast. In aged care, you know, COVID plus business models plus Royal Commissions and, yeah, finance, the sort of financial hit. So everybody's had to adapt and to change and so on. And I guess what we talked about in Toolkit were probably really four things. One was the mental model that you bring to this. So do you bring I need to weather this and then I need to get out of it?
Mm.
Or do you bring a mindset of, actually, I can build capability. I can use the experience here. So just as an athlete, I want to put an athlete into a challenging situation. I want to send them overseas. I want to put them into big competitions so they can build their capabilities and learn.
Mm.
So we talk about that as being like the pathway. So that's almost like your first piece. The second bit is then, how do I calibrate a mindset that can deal with change? Well, first thing is, what's your current relationship to change? Yeah, do you like it? Do you resist it? Yeah, can you engage with it a bit? Are you a change junkie? And then it's just, if we've got perfectionism laid across the top of this, it's helping people to recognize, and obviously, cover a small amount here, but I quite like William Bridges' model. But Bridges has this simple framework where he calls transitions. And he says, change is the stuff that physically happens in the world. So a new competitor comes into your area, a staff member leaves, you restructure your business. That's change. Transition is the psychological change that goes with that, the transition. And that is a process of three pieces. Loss, you've got to leave something behind. A period of uncertainty as you start to understand and kind of come to grips with that, and then a new beginning. And in order to get through that, you need tools. Mm. And that's where Toolkit for Turbulence came from. So some of those tools are self-awareness. Some of those tools we've talked about, ADEP, Achieve, Develop, Enjoy, Partner, having clarity about what that is, using people that provide you with perspective, coaches, mentors, and so on. Knowing what that longer-term goal is, the classic Stockdale paradox, which is believe in the long term, but deal with the harsh realities of the moment, good to great, which I think you mentioned in a podcast recently. So it's that ability to deal with the loss and to move through is the key. And there's so many little sort of simple little tools to that, many of which we've covered already. It's just awareness and learning with some support, basically.
Can I just touch on the emotional journey?
Yeah, of course.
Around that, because dealing with loss is not always easy.
Yeah.
And that could throw up all manner of emotions for the person who's struggling with change or feels like the rug's been pulled out from under them or whatever. What are the key emotional journeys that people go on during change? And then how do you make sure that you're responding rather than reacting so that you can really be emotionally intelligent rather than just reacting?
Yeah, a lot of the work we did with our clients through COVID was bringing out basic grief models and helping people to recognize that natural tendency to perhaps deny or to be overly anxious and overly upset about it and so on. But the fact is, it's still a natural human reaction. I guess in simple terms, what we talk about is the difference between an adaptive mindset and a defensive or protective mindset.
Yes.
So there is a kind of natural tendency when we feel out of control, we human beings, dentists would appreciate, I think there were some good studies out of one of the medical colleges in London, which was talking about when people have a diagnosis of a serious, potentially life-threatening illness, if you map their stress levels are higher before they get the final diagnosis. Their stress levels will drop once they get the diagnosis. So they may have a very bad diagnosis and prognosis, but their stress levels drop, which to me tells me that humans love certainty. So it's that ability. I mean, we call it let go, welcome the squirm, which is a little bit of a throwaway line, but it is that ability to accept that I'm going to feel the level of squirm, engage with it, and then move into it. And that to me is personally, and working with athletes, something that I often have sitting and encourage athletes to have it sitting there as a triangle. Accept, engage, advance, which basically means feel a bit squirmy about this. I'm feeling anxious on, okay, but it's consistent with where I want to go. I'm going to engage with it. I'm going to give it a go and I'm going to move forward. I'm going to do something with it. So it's the ability to move forward. And often as a psych or as a coach, what you're endeavoring to do is to challenge the person to leave some things behind, leave old habits behind. I think one of the funniest stories in Toolkit for Turbulence is a chap called Paul Doldig. So Paul's been a client of mine for many years. He was the senior head of operations for Australian National University for about 3 or 4 years, including during COVID. And he just tells a story of about 3 months out from COVID, his IT team came to him and said, we're just about to roll out Microsoft Office. We've got SharePoint, etc. And they said, we found this thing. It's free. There's a license for it. It's called Teams. We're not really sure what it is. We think we could use it to get departments and faculties to connect with each other, but we reckon it'd take maybe 3 to 5 years to get it to sort of roll out with all the sort of change management processes. But it looks interesting. 3 months later or 4 months later, the entire university is operating on Teams.
Yeah, wow.
So it's interesting, isn't it? There was a forced ending.
Yeah.
So then you're in the middle of, I can't go back. It's burned the boats. I can't go back. I'm going to have to learn how to adapt. And that I find with certainly some of the people I'm coaching with is helping them to hold the tension. You know, with cricketers, we often talk about hold the tension through this period, but be clear where you want to go. Be clear what your intent is. And I know in the work you do, and I've heard many of your podcasts, you're consistently saying, be clear what your vision is. Be clear what your purpose is. Be clear what that higher order thing is. You can't be certain how you're going to get there, but you can be certain that you're going to have to deal with loss as you go through that. And as you say, there's a whole lot of emotional regulation, and it's natural to go into defensive mode. Entirely natural. If you don't, we actually got a problem.
Okay.
But the question is, how do I then turn that towards a more adaptive mindset? And a constructive adaptive mindset is going to have a mix of achievement, and it's going to have a mix of coaching and developing and bringing people with you. It's that, yeah, again, it's that vertical line, task on one side, people on the other. I think if I'm coaching dentists, I'm saying your orientation is very much likely to be towards task. I want you to have almost like the pilot's checklist that's got the five things that you might forget. They're probably people things.
Oh, 100%. And I can tell you, this feels like a confessional at the moment. Sometimes when I write emails, I have to go back and write the salutations or the, you know, hope you're well and all that kind of stuff, you know, because I get so caught up in the fact that I just want to get my message done, complete the task and all the rest of it, that you're right, I actually have to stop and check myself and go, hang on, have I said hello? How's your weekend? Yeah. You know, those social niceties that need to kind of create a well-rounded piece of communication. I sometimes forget, so I have to remind myself to do that sometimes. I tend to be a bit task-focused from time to time. Graham, you've been very generous with your time, and I don't want to impose on your time too much. You've got a couple of books out. You've done an incredible service to the people you work with, and of course the people that I work with as well. You know, Toolkits for Turbulence, Think One Team, all those sorts of resources there. For people listening to the podcast and who want to find out, you know, where to start, if they were going, you know, I really like this conversation that we've had, which is the best jumping off point for them? Is it to dive into Toolkit for Turbulence, or is it somewhere else? Where would you recommend people get started?
If their issue is team and building their team and their practice, then it's Think One Team. And that was the Think One Team was originally written in about 2008, I think, something like that. And the third edition's just come out in the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks. So that's that's more of a story with a model that sits behind it. And it is purely based on building a team. So if that's what your focus is, but many of the tools are then covered in Toolkit for Turbulence. If on the other hand, I think people are saying, well, actually I'm a leader. I really want to work on myself. And I want to work on my business and my ability, you know, almost like to be a business athlete, then Toolkit for Turbulence. Alongside that, my favorite business book from the last few years is Essentialism.
Oh, yeah, Greg McKeown.
Greg McKeown.
Yeah, it's a great book.
I found that incredibly useful. And there is a book, the author is of whom I'm struggling to remember, but there is a brilliant book written in the 1990s called Too Perfect, When Being in Control Gets Out of Control.
Ah, okay.
So Too Perfect, When Being in Control Gets Out of Control. Written by a couple of New York psychiatrists, written for professionals. People like us will pick the book up, read a chapter and go, oh, my God, they've been following us. There'll be other chapters you'll read and you go, I don't do this, because it gives you the sort of different elements of perfectionism.
Yeah.
I don't know how many I know it's available on Kindle. I don't know how many of those books I have referred to clients, business clients, professional clients over the years. It'd be in the hundreds. I find that, and I personally found that an incredibly useful book. So written about 1998, maybe, or something like that.
Right. Too Perfect. Okay.
Well, sits on my Kindle and still gets. I can remember when I first got it and I had the highlight pen. It looked like something colored it in. Yeah. There were very few lines that weren't colored in.
You feel like someone's speaking directly to you. I'm in my very own counseling session right there.
Yeah.
Graham, you've been really generous with your time. I'd love to just ask you one last question, if I may, because you have been the chief psychologist for three Olympic teams. And I feel like, you know, we've spoken a lot about team, we've spoken a lot about business. I'm really curious to ask you about just that experience and what you learned being up close and personal in such a concentrated environment with, you know, a very small cohort of the society. You know, the Olympic athletes, I don't know, 1 in 10,000 of us might become an Olympic athlete. I'm not sure whatever the stat is, but yeah, you've got a very concentrated group of high performers in one area for a short period of time. What did you learn? What did you observe? What did you take away from those three Olympic Games as key takeaways or observations?
Wow. I think this may not sound particularly philosophical, but I think just because you achieve a extrinsic outcome like winning a medal, etc., doesn't make people happy and doesn't make them fulfilled. I don't think there's a particularly strong relationship between mental well-being, life happiness, and success at that level. Now, recognizing that the people in the team have all reached the Olympic level.
Yeah.
But I think for some, once they reach that level, they then go, yeah, but is that it? I think what I learned probably is the journey, not the destination.
Mm-hmm.
I think the ones who have more rounded and balanced, if we come to the ADEP, the ones that are not all just totally focused on the A and are burning relationships and, you know, squeezing every piece out of themselves, there will be a cost. And that cost often does come out for athletes over time. So maybe just a final comment. Yeah, and I said it earlier, just because you're elite psychologically or just because you're elite in your profession doesn't mean that you're elite psychologically, but it also doesn't mean that you are weak or that you're deficient psychologically. It just means that maybe you haven't trained, maybe you don't have some tools in that area. And I think the most fulfilled lives I see of athletes are the ones who have been able to find a balance that works for them. Some have won Olympic gold medals, some have not. But they've kind of achieved on their own terms.
Yeah.
And they've recognized the trade-off and the balance of family and relationships and so on. And I think they're wealthier, healthier, happier from that rather than the ones that have maybe just relentlessly pursued Everest without, you know, giving thought to the cost of it.
Same with business, I imagine, too.
Very much so. Yeah. And probably more so in the last 4 or 5 years. I've seen more chief executives and senior executives in tears in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years than I think I ever have. And I think that's because of that sense of, there's a sense of burnout and frustration that I've put in everything, I've done everything here, and I still haven't got there. And of course, where are you trying to get to? Yeah. What's important to you? I think perspective is so important to be able to, and when you're putting yourself in those high demand environments, they are high demand environments.
Yeah. What have I sacrificed at the altar of success, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Graham, really rich, interesting conversation today. As always, mate, I really value you taking the time to come and talk to us. And ladies and gents, please go ahead and grab those resources, whether it's Think One Team or Toolkit for Turbulence or the Greg McEwen book, which is Essentialism or Too Perfect. Again, grab some of those resources because I think developing that mental fitness, that psychological fitness, is going to be just as important as building business fitness, probably more so in many respects. And if we're going to create a rich and rewarding life, we talk about building a practice and a life that you love. And I think that and is really important. We don't want it to be an either or. Let's make sure we get the and in there. And Graham, I really just want to say thank you so much for a really thought-provoking, stimulating conversation that I've enjoyed immensely. So thank you once again, mate.
Thanks, Jesse. You made it very easy to have a stimulating conversation. So thanks for the work that you do as well.
I appreciate it, mate. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.